This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers, coming to you from Gadigal land. Skilled migration and getting more people into work are the topics set to dominate day two of the Jobs Summit. And people with disabilities say they want to be a part of picking up more work. Political reporter Dana Morse has more.
If there's one thing the 150 delegates at the Jobs and Skills Summit agree on, it's that Australia desperately needs more workers. There's a growing feeling that the nation has failed to tap into some key groups. One of those is people living with disabilities, many of whom are already proving their value in the workplace.
What I do in my team is a big achievement, and I should be more proud of the things I do.
Brittany Lloyd has Asperger's syndrome, and she's been working as a project assistant with the New South Wales government for almost a year. But initially, she struggled to find employment.
Very frustrating, like the times where you just like cry and in your room is like, oh, what am I doing wrong? And
Brittany Lloyd says prospective employers saw her condition as a problem.
When you mention the word Asperger's or autism, everyone's eyes seem to like die down a bit. It's like, oh, I don't want people to see me as my diagnosis. I just want them to see me as me.
But that's not the case in her current job, where she's thriving.
They see me as Brittany, like the person who can help me with all the things I have on my plate, and she can make it so much easier for my workload.
Increasing free TAFE places, skilled migration, and getting mothers back into work with cheaper childcare were all discussed on the Job Summit's main stage yesterday. Today, the focus will shift to boosting worker numbers, including encouraging more participation. Those in the disability sector want to take advantage of that conversation.
We've had this opportunity before, and we've dropped the ball.
That's Dylan Alcott, Australian of the Year and disability advocate. He told the summit there's no reason for people with disabilities to be overlooked.
It's just bloody good business as well, because people with disability are 90% more likely to be equal to or more productive than able-bodied people. We have higher retention rates, lower absenteeism, 61% increase in workplace morale when people with disability are hired, 49% increase in skill gaps, yet the unemployment rate of people with disability is more than double, almost triple that of able-bodied people.
He says there should be more pathways.
Some people want a job, for sure. But do you know what else some people want? They want a career. They want a leadership position. I don't want to scare you, but we want your seats.
Chris Chippendale from Life Without Barriers says there needs to be an attitude shift towards disability and work.
Unfortunately, disability is often constructed generally in the community as a deficit and not as an attribute, if you like, or you know, just part of someone's life.
Policy levers to increase workforce participation are on the agenda for today, but Mr. Chippendale says clarity is key.
Often those programs are confusing, they operate in silos, and therefore the government and the people at the Job Summit need to really make sure that those programs are properly designed, working well, coordinated. We've got an untapped potential of really good employees.
Now it's on the government to make the most of it.
Dana Morse reporting. Well, one of the keys to solving workforce shortages is to train more people. There are going to be 180,000 fee-free TAFE places across the country, with the cost shared between the federal, state and territory governments. But will it make a difference to the skills crisis? Isabel Massali reports.
Perth man Lachlan had been thinking about studying cybersecurity for a while. In the end, it came down to cost.
The reason I did it was because they slashed the prices because of like COVID and stuff like that. So I paid about like $500 for the full semester, which I didn't think was too bad.
He's backing a new plan to bring 180,000 free TAFE places forward to next year.
I think it's a good idea, yeah. Get people, like free education is always a good thing.
It's also got the tick of approval from these high-vis wearing students at the East Perth TAFE campus.
I reckon it's pretty good trying to get people to take surveying, as we kind of need a couple more people in the jobs.
I think it's a great idea. Like if there's a shortage across many industries with jobs, I think it gives people an incentive to get out there and study or learn something new, which is exactly what I'm doing. So
the $1.1 billion package was announced on day one of the Jobs and Skills Summit and will be jointly funded with state and territory governments. Diane Dayhew is the CEO of the National Apprentice Employment Network.
We are going to need thousands of more apprenticeships over coming years. So we think that this is going to really open up the way for many more opportunities for young people. So we definitely see it as a positive. Whether it's in traditional trades, the care economy, traineeships or skill sets.
Jenny Dodd from TAFE Directors Australia has also warmly welcomed the package.
We do have, for the first time in decades, a three on the number of unemployment. That means we have to look at where we can train our Australians, where we can give them skills and qualifications that will help them to be able to acquire those qualifications and skills that are needed in our workplace.
And while the details are yet to be worked out, she wants it to include support services such as counsellors and digital literacy training.
Any expansion in a program like this, which we absolutely welcome, because fee-free TAFE is about access and equity, and it unquestionably provides opportunities for people to come into training who might not otherwise. Often those sorts of students will require additional support to be able to be successful in their learning and outcomes.
How confident are you that you'll have enough teaching staff to be able to roll this out?
Like every industry, TAFE is challenged, like every industry, in terms of its own skill shortages. But we will work through with industry, and I think that's about the partnership that we have with employers, is being able to solve this together.
Australian Education Union President Karina Haythorpe agrees it'll be a challenge, but she's confident they can secure enough teachers.
Look, over many years, TAFE has been subjected to cuts, and that has caused TAFE campuses to close and courses to be shut down and a subsequent loss of the teaching workforce. We're now in a position where we've seen a major announcement by the ALP in terms of a $1.1 billion package with public TAFE at its heart, and we're very much looking forward to helping deliver that with our members.
President of the Australian Education Union, Karina Haythorpe, ending that report from Isabel Massali. It's taken a while, but the New South Wales government has finally responded to a damning parliamentary inquiry into regional healthcare, which identified gaps in services and a chronic shortage of workers. The Perrottet government's accepted most of the 44 recommendations, but not everyone is satisfied it'll create the kind of change that's needed. Matt Bamford reports.
Paul Mara has been a doctor in rural New South Wales for around 40 years. When it comes to the state of regional healthcare, the former president of the New South Wales Rural Doctors Association is blunt.
Well, there's a crisis in rural healthcare delivery. Systems right across the state have been falling apart.
Earlier this year, a parliamentary inquiry came to the same conclusion. Hundreds of hours of evidence revealed a sector struggling with under-resourcing, staff shortages and a toxic culture. Local Government New South Wales President Daria Turley was among those who participated. The Broken Hill councillor says it's costing lives in her community.
You know, our heart breaks every time we hear a story about someone passing who could have survived, you know, if they had access treatment.
Now the Perrottet government has responded. It supports fully or in principle 41 of the 44 recommendations, including a review into funding for local health districts and a new recruitment strategy. This on top of over $4 billion already pledged for 10,000 additional health staff in the next 4 years. But Ian Kammerman from the Rural Doctors Association of New South Wales says overall it's a disappointing response.
Really is quite underwhelming. There certainly is some positives, but they really haven't come across some of the what I see as, and my colleagues see as, very much the major issues.
They include the need for better wages to attract doctors to the bush.
The award was something that was created in 1987, and it's worse for wear. There's no commitment from the government to actually modernise that agreement.
A recommendation to create a watchdog for handling internal complaints and medical cover-ups also failed to get support.
We don't understand why, considering all the work that's gone into this inquiry.
And while money for more doctors is welcome, Dr. Paul Mara says there's no strategy for luring them out of the city.
In the bush, it's about servicing a community need on a 24-hour basis, often across multiple settings, such as a practice, general practice, or a hospital.
Dr. Paul Mara says so far it's hard to imagine much changing.
And I can't see any point in throwing money at organisations and solutions that have failed on a continual basis. I mean, it's just not viable to do that. And it would appear that that's what the government's doing.
Broken Hill councillor Daria Turley is trying to keep an open mind.
Let's see how they're implemented, the recommendations. Let's see on the ground. Do we see another story of a six-year-old who dies who cannot be evacuated on time?
In a statement, Minister for Regional Health, Bronnie Taylor, says New South Wales residents deserve access to quality health care no matter where they live.
Matt Bamford reporting. A United Nations inspection team has finally made it into the Ukrainian nuclear power plant that's been occupied by the Russian military. Ukraine alleges Russia is using it as a shield to launch attacks, while Moscow accuses Ukraine of recklessly firing on the area. As Alexandra Humphreys reports, some of the UN inspectors are now going to stay at the site.
As clashes near the Russian-occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power plant escalate, anxiety has been growing. After months of negotiations, a team from the International Atomic Energy Agency, headed by Rafael Grossi, has now gone inside.
I worry, and I will continue to be worried about the plant until we have a situation which is more stable, which is more predictable. It is obvious that the plant and the physical integrity of the plant has been violated several times, by chance, by deliberation. We don't have the elements to assess that, but this is a reality that we have to recognize, and this is something that cannot continue to happen.
Mr. Grossi says the Ukrainian workers who have kept the plant operating since it was occupied by Russia in the early days of the six-month war have displayed incredible professionalism. The plant was knocked offline last week when fires burned nearby. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says only backup generators prevented catastrophe. Both sides have accused the other of attacking the plant. Officials have begun distributing anti-radiation iodine tablets to nearby residents. Having passed through the front lines after delays due to heavy shelling, Mr. Grossi described a difficult and dangerous situation on the ground.
We are not going anywhere. The IAEA is now there, is at the plant, and is not moving. It's going to stay there. We're going to have a continued presence there at the plant with some of my experts.
Dr. Ross Peel is from the Department of War Studies at King's College London and researches the role of nuclear power plants in war.
This IAEA visit is something that the international community and people like myself have been looking for a long time. We've seen countless claims from both sides of shelling and what is going on at the plant, but it's been very, very difficult to verify exactly what has been going on.
Dr. Peel says it's a newer plant than Chernobyl, with different safety features, but there is still a risk of a radiation leak.
It's something that would require either a direct attack on the plant, which would damage some of the critical safety systems of the plant and would release radiation directly, such as damage to the reactors or the spent nuclear fuel cooling ponds. Or it could be through an indirect route whereby the critical safety systems that keep the water that's needed cool the nuclear materials flowing and keep that heat being taken away to prevent the fuel overheating. Any damage to those systems could allow that fuel to get too hot and potentially melt, catch fire, or have other problems.
The agency says it's collected important information, but its assessment is continuing.
Alexandra Humphreys. Pakistan is bracing for yet more flooding. The country's Disaster Management Authority says record monsoon rainfall and melting glaciers in northern mountains have triggered the floods, which have so far claimed more than 1,000 lives. Aid is trickling into remote areas where flooding has displaced tens of thousands of people and destroyed homes and crops. Rachel Mealy reports.
Trucks carrying desperately needed food have finally arrived in Rajin, a southern district of Punjab. The region, which already experiences extreme poverty, has seen houses and crops destroyed by flooding, and thousands of people are now huddling in makeshift tents on what little dry land they can find.
We've been displaced by the water for the past 15 days. We've lost everything, but until today, we received nothing.
Further south, in the Shikarpur district of Sindh province, Mundam Ali says the people have been forgotten. mountain. I am 7 months pregnant, she says. I have a lot of pain in my back and whooping cough. I'm here because my house collapsed in the rain. Nobody takes care of the poor people. Officials come here only for photographs. And doctors came, gave medication for one day and went away. Adil Shiraz is the country director for Care International. He says the scale of this flood hasn't been seen in recent times.
I'm one of that aid worker who has worked in 2010 flood also. And when I compare the 2010 flood with this flood, this is 3 or 4 times bigger than the 2010 flood.
Months of unrelenting rainfall has left rivers swollen and catchments saturated, and there's more on the way. Dr. Helen Griffiths is a natural hazards researcher at the University of Reading.
The totals that we're seeing at the moment are unprecedented. That's kind of the key word, and it's really important. We've seen this quite a few times over this summer. We're seeing things that we've never seen before in history.
Another surge of water is flowing down the Indus River, threatening further devastation. Pakistan's chief meteorologist, Sardar Safaraz, says the cause of the flooding is clear.
Basically, there are several factors causing our rainfall. Pacific Ocean temperatures, Indian Ocean temperatures, and there's been excessive heat from March to June. Now, that extra heating created low pressure, and the monsoon axis remained tilted to the south, which is why more rainfall occurred in southern Pakistan.
The World Health Organization says more than 6.4 million people are in dire need of humanitarian aid.
Rachel Mealy. A small coastal city with a population of less than 500,000 people holds the unenviable title of the most expensive place in the world. Tel Aviv in Israel has seen prices of food, rent, petrol and electricity soar in recent years, but it's not because of inflation, which is still lower than in Australia. Rather, economists say it's a combination of government-created problems. Middle East correspondent Alison Horn reports from Tel Aviv.
On the streets of Tel Aviv, angry Israelis are rallying against the soaring cost of living. Tel Aviv has been named the world's most costly place by global research group, the Economist Intelligence Unit. Mother of five, Dekla Shah, is one of a growing number of Israelis struggling to survive.
Prices are climbing all the time. Petrol, the price of bread, which is a basic food item, rent. Once it was affordable, today it's not.
A car accident last year left Ms. Shah unable to work and afford rent, so the family had no choice but to move into a tent in a public park. Her husband now earns just over $2,500 Australian dollars per month, but Ms. Shah says a two-bedroom apartment in one of the poorest neighbourhoods of Tel Aviv would cost her about $3,000 per month.
This is a very painful feeling. It feels so bad as a mum. I have done a lot for my kids. I've worked so hard to keep them happy, but I have nothing to give them.
The Israeli currency, the shekel, has seen a massive appreciation in recent years compared to the US dollar, driving up local prices. But economists also see several government-created problems for residents here, like high taxes, limited imports with large tariffs, and a local production market that's controlled by only a handful of companies, creating a monopoly. Economics professor Elise Braziz from Bar-Ilan University says Tel Aviv has been hit by a perfect storm.
They're a small country, so production is done by some companies having a lot of monopoly power. Now, take into consideration there are very high tariffs. One problem on top of the other one is making everything much more acute.
When the ABC visited a suburban Tel Aviv supermarket, the cheapest loaf of brown bread was about $9 Australian. 2 litres of milk cost about $6, and a kilo of chuck beef steak would set a family back $30 Australian. Professor Braziz says basics are becoming unaffordable for some.
And when you look at the supermarket, you will see that Most of the goods are affected.
Politicians are coming under increasing pressure to reduce government taxes and open up the market to allow more competition, both inside Israel and from abroad. The issue has emerged as the number one concern for Israelis heading into November's general election. This is Alison Horn in Tel Aviv, reporting for AM.
And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency have rushed to Zaporizhia in Ukraine's southeast to assess Europe's largest nuclear plant that's controlled by Russia and has been under increasing attack. Today, physicist Edwin Lyman on the very real threat of a radioactive meltdown. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.